It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.
Welcome to this special programme which we're recording on the 12th of November, which is Remembrance Sunday.
I'm Adele.
I'm Gudrun.
I'm Wayne.
And I'm still David.
And we have a special guest.
Hello, I'm Brian from Glasgow.
From Glasgow.
Yeah, you know, I was just noting, there's an article in the Evening Standard, although it's 8th of September 2017, it highlights that 59 Met police officers sacked or punished for racist behaviour. Now, of course, you know, that's quite alarming figures, albeit the fact that the 59 police officers is an indication that, you know, such people exist in the force. Now, over a period of, okay, it's talking about a period of five years. Now, what do you think to that? Yeah.
Well, I was reading it as well, because I must admit, I didn't see the article originally. Mm. But it's over a period of 5 years, and it's 59, but how many were actually dismissed? I think, was it 18?
Yeah. 18 dismissed following complaints about race discrimination, and 41 were subject to other disciplinary sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, to me that's an indication that there is an issue with recruitment, about how you recruit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, maybe these, we don't know the full story of this article, doesn't give the full story, but it could be that, I don't know, you know, how did these people, how were they found out? That's what I want to know. I mean, did they have CCTV information, or, you know, some people give evidence, you know, a witness, for example, which means that there are others that are not being mm-hmm. caught, you know, and, you know, causing problems in the police.
Mm.
Anyway, I thought it was an article worth mentioning because I think some people find it hard to believe that such people exist in the force, and of course such people, you know, are bringing down the name of the police force, the Met Police and otherwise, you know, and I think it's useful that people know that these things are happening. Anyway, it's also an indication that there are things changing. There is a bit of a clean-up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well,
what about in this borough, then?
Well, it doesn't highlight any particular borough.
Right.
I haven't noted that. It's not really a large article, and it is actually on page 14. So they didn't really make a big song and a dance about it. And you know, the article goes on to talk about 1999 McPherson report and all that kind of stuff. So even the key part of the article doesn't really highlight, you know, too much about the Met Police sackings and so on. So, so maybe there's a lot that they're not telling us. But who knows? But it's great to find out a bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe the police would like to report a little bit more is going on. At least they give people a bit more confidence that it's been cleaned up.
Yes. Right. Well, we'll perhaps pick it up at another stage, shall we, Wayne?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll leave. Yeah.
Right. Yes, and maybe if people are here have some their own experience, they can tell us.
Yeah, if any listeners would like to get in touch, that would be very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or if you are a policeman or woman,
yes,
would like to talk to us, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really good.
So. Right, so have we had an update on Right to a Life?
Well, you know, Right to Life, I'm really pleased with the way things are going with Right to a Life.
Okay.
just to remind people that we still have a closing date, well, I'd say closing date, a deadline of the 7th of January. We still want to hear from 11 to 16-year-olds. So parents, teachers, youth workers, you know, please encourage your young people to write. Their themes are hope, life, and health. And there are prizes. We're sort of really working hard to make sure that there are going to be prizes available. But apart from that, we do want people to do something, which is part of our slogan, doing something memorable for self and charity. And
we should mention that the main prize, in a way, is publication in what will hopefully be a very well-produced book with an introduction by the mayor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which will look good on your CV, hopefully.
That's what I think it would look good. And, I bumped into about 20 or 30 young people in the street on Friday. And I was handing them out leaflets, and some of them were really showing a lot of interest. They, you know, there's some real budding writers out there. And it's really just for them to sort of recognize that this is a golden opportunity. And, you know, I'd like to make a mention that we received. I got in touch with Churchill Estates, with their, you know, the property agents, and they have helped us with some leaflets. So they gave us literally hundreds of leaflets to put out in the streets and into the schools and wherever. So that's, you know, Churchill Estates, I give you thanks. They've written on the bottom here, proud to support Right to a Life. And, you know, I'd give a big mention to Gary Clark, who is the manager there, who was really impressed by the whole project. And you know, he really showed a lot of support and interest in this work.
One little thing that I think, to be honest, we need to apologise for is it says that there's a spoken version of the rules on the website. In fact, it's out of date, and we really need to update that spoken version.
Right.
We will.
Yeah,
we will.
Don't worry. We'll do that. So that just means, you know, recognize that the rules are already written there. So follow the rules written in, you know, and then because those are accurate, and we'll do the update as David mentions.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Okay, so today is the 12th of November. It is the day after Remembrance Day. But because this is a Sunday, many people have been remembering what happened in both world wars. Gudrun, I think you have something to talk about.
Yes, because in Germany is very different. When I grew up and it was just after the Second World War, nobody talked about war again. The main thing was never war again. And there was no real remembrance. They have one day called Volkstrauertag in November too, a day of mourning, but it's not so with like here in England with the celebrations and 2 minutes silent and
the cenotaph, where the Queen is gathered with
and all this.
Right, you don't have the marches or the
processions. No, we don't have anything. Right. We have this mourning maybe is individual. And of course they have in the local communities, they have the tables with names who died in the war and such things. But this, and I thought when I see now here this Remembrance Day, I think it's a contrast between the remembrance and the thing they are doing today and the weapons they built and the wars are going on. Mm. You see, it's I don't know the English word now, but it sounds a little bit like...
It's a contradiction.
A contradiction, and then you make this once a year and so, and keep for 2 minutes silent, but it has no consequence in your doing and your
thinking.
You're
still building weapons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And selling them to countries like Saudi Arabia to bomb the Yemen, Israel to bomb the Palestinians.
And the idea, oh, this is the right to do, when this is my interest, I just fight for my own interest and for nothing else. And I think now it's much more common even. They forgot all the sorrow and all the horror that was in the First World War. They just here celebrate, but it's not the spirit inside anymore.
Yes, I think there's a big danger of glorifying war in all these Remembrance Day events. That's why I wear a white poppy. The point of that is that you're not glorifying war. I mean, I do in fact contribute to the Royal British Legion because it is for the upkeep of families who have had people killed by the government. You know, I think the people were fools to go into the army. I mean, they would, if they were alive, would no doubt agree. It's a horrific setup from top to bottom. And I try not to glorify it, and that's the big danger.
Yes, I think so. And I think now the nationalism, patriotism, and this is too much now. It's getting worse.
Nationalism is on the up again,
Yes.
There's a lot of word of the EU having its own army.
Yes,
European
of course,
army, in
everybody.
Which case I'm glad we got out of it in time.
Yes. and Germany, they had a defense army. They called it defense army. And actually, they are not allowed to take part in any war. But this thing all, what do they do in Afghanistan then? This defense is not a defense. They told the people, oh, we defend our freedom even in Afghanistan. This is not true. Even the Kosovo war, it's very questioning whether this was right or not right.
It certainly is.
Yes.
Why did we invade Iraq twice?
Yes.
Were they threatening us? Of course not.
No, not.
Total nonsense.
Yes.
Just economic interests of America.
Those are all not wars which are justified and don't make the world anything better, even worse.
Nobody wins a war. Mm. It doesn't happen. Everybody's worse off at the end.
You told something about a speech somebody heard.
Harry Patch?
Yes.
Yeah, he died at the age of, I think it was 112. And I'd like to play a little talk that he had with Tony Blair, in fact. It's a very interesting dialogue. We'll play it in a few minutes.
Oh, yes. That is very good.
Yeah. So the red poppy is worn... and the donation goes to the Royal British Legion, commemorate the soldiers who died in the war, and the white poppy is worn alongside or instead of to remember, as a symbol of peace. But there's also a purple poppy, and the purple poppy was created apparently in 2006 to remember the animal victims of war. You know, so that all that money goes to the animal aid,
and they certainly had a hard time. If anybody's seen the stage play War Horse, you'll know the way animals were treated in the First World War. These words were spoken by the English poet, actor, political activist and dramatist Heathcote Williams, who died last June, on behalf of the Stop the War Coalition.
At the age of 111, Harry Patch, the last surviving soldier from World War I, gave strict instructions for his funeral. There should be no weapons on display. Harry said that war was calculated slaughter, and that the dead were victims of governments, and that the war wasn't worth one life. The last living witness to the war to end all wars would stoutly declare that he'd no time for thieving politicians' lies. Early in the war, he'd made his own small bid to end it, to end that war to end all wars. Harry'd made a pact with five fellow soldiers that they'd never kill a man, that they'd never kill a single enemy. According to King's regulations, their pacifist pact would have been a capital offence had Harry and his mates been discovered, and, ever afterwards, Harry would allude to it with a guarded chuckle, as if he could be arrested for it still. escorted to the regimental guardhouse, and even put before a firing squad, and shot for his treason nearly a century on. Just after the illegal invasion of Iraq, a real traitor, the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, hoped to meet Harry, now becoming well known as the Last Tommy, with a view to his exploiting him in a photo opportunity designed to heighten Blair's own profile. After Blair effected the introduction, he edged towards Harry's wheelchair, then hovered beside him, grinning, as if attempting to absorb his stardust and even claim it, in some way, for his own. But unexpectedly, he met with Harry's sharp rebuff. Harry regaled him with the Harry Patch remedy for conflict resolution, namely that politicians who took us to war should have been given the guns and told to settle their differences themselves, instead of organizing nothing better than legalized mass murder. Harry also told him that nobody during the First World War should have been shot for cowardice, as war is organized killing, and nothing else. Harry Patch had done what no war crimes tribunal has yet succeeded in, namely, to make the despised war criminal and profiteer, Anthony Charles Linton Blair, squirm, make his excuses, and scuttle off.
With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hurroo, hurroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you. Oh, my darling dear, you look so queer. Johnny, I hardly knew ya. Where are your legs that used to run, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your legs that used to run, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your legs that used to run when first you went to carry a gun? Now I fear your dancing days are done, Johnny, I hardly knew ya. Where are your arms that held me tight, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your arms that held me tight, hurroo, hurroo? Where are your arms that held me tight when first you went to join the fight? And we'll never no more share the night, Johnny, I hardly knew ya. They're rolling out the drums again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the drums again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the drums again, they're stirring up the boys and men. And I fear we'll never see the end, Johnny, I hardly knew ya.
Janice Ian.
Okay, and here is the forest roundup for November and December. At the mill, we have Super Wednesdays. We have the kitchen brings delicious homemade soup to the mill every Wednesday in November. £2.50 a person, and it's from 12 o'clock until 3 o'clock. We have had notice of comms boot camp for 16 to 22 year olds at the mill. I think that's probably organised by Charlotte.
Who's comm?
Comms is communications.
Oh, comms, yes.
Yes, so we have communications boot camp. We had one in the summer, I think, David, didn't we?
I think so.
And this is going to be the Saturday the 18th and Sunday the 19th of November. We also have a Christmas pop-up pottery at the mill, which is on Thursday the 30th of November. And a couple of other things I wanted to talk about were our regular Scrabble, which is on Thursdays, Scrabble and Conversation, from 12 o'clock until 1:30. And also, for the point of view of our guest here, Brian, the Tuesday we have a sociable sewing group.
Oh, really?
At the mill. Pound donation to the mill and small costs for materials.
Wonderful idea.
And as somebody who's, I believe you've just taken on sewing.
I have bought a sewing machine. It's not quite the same thing as taking on sewing, I must admit.
But you might be taking on some things for me, perhaps.
Oh, right.
And we have a knitting workshop regularly, a pound donation, drop-in session, and that's Wednesdays and Fridays. Wednesdays in the evening, 6:30 to 8, Fridays in the morning, 10 until 1 o'clock. And we also have community acupuncture clinic, which I must confess I've never been to, but it sounds quite interesting, and that's the mill on Tuesdays, 4:30 to 7:30. And one more thing at the mill is the counsellor's surgery, which takes place on the second Saturday of the month. So we've just had Saturday the 11th, and so the next one will be in two Saturdays' time at the mill. Right, we've also got to talk about the Mall development, and there is going to be a meeting in the Assembly Hall on the 29th, which is, which day is the 29th?
It's a Wednesday,
29th of November, and it is to do with the planning approval application to be discussed by the Mall. And David, do you have something to say on this?
Well, it's to be discussed by the council. It's the actual meeting at which they'll make a decision on whether or not to build the monster block, as it's come to be known. Originally it was 27 stories, then it became 29. Now it's no number of stories, it's become a height, 132.5 metres, which is 15.5 metres higher than Centre Point on Oxford Street in London.
Higher
than Centre Point.
And how many stories?
Nobody knows. They haven't given any number of stories. Roughly. But they're applying for what's called outline planning permission, which means they can put anything they like up to that height, basically, so long as it doesn't contravene building regulations. So outline planning permission doesn't sound dangerous. It's actually very dangerous because there's no actual clearly defined scheme. It's just an outline, and provided they stick to that outline, they can pretty much do whatever they like. So it's an extremely important meeting. Please try to come to it, make your voice heard. It's in the Assembly Hall, which seats roughly 1,000 people, so they're expecting a big attendance. Let's not disappoint them, and do say what you think about this proposal. There are other aspects besides the tower block. I won't go into them all here, we've gone into them many, many times. And if you want to look into it a bit further, just go to Facebook and go to a page called Save Walthamstow's Town Centre, and you'll get all the facts and figures there. Okay?
Thank you very much, David. So that's 29th of November, and what time is
the meeting? 7 in the evening.
7 in the evening, okay. Wayne, I think you had something to say about a news update.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for some people, if they remember, a couple of months ago, I think it was late August or even early August, the Pete Thomas, he's a senior advisor as part of the environmental agency. He was saying, okay, that flood risk in Walthamstow, calling the Dagenham Brook Flood Alleviation Scheme. Now, he wrote to me just this week saying that actually, he says, I'll read what he says. He said, unfortunately, after carrying out further investigations, we have found that the proposed scheme will increase flood risks downstream. So he's basically saying that the scheme isn't going to go ahead anymore. And he said that the cost will be too great. And he's inviting people to get in touch with him if they want to meet, and he'll discuss the idea and discuss what the reasons behind it. He'll do that. I've written to Pete and asked him to get back to me because I thought it'd be good that it seems as he spoke to us on radio, he should then sort of talk to us and say, well, what's gone wrong? So I'm waiting to hear from him. That's the outcome so far.
Okay, thank you, Wayne.
There's one other thing that we could come back to briefly, because very early on in our career, I think when we were still Mill Radio, we interviewed the world champion Scrabble player, whose name is Brett Smitherham. And we have just had an event organised by Adele at which Brett came along and helped run the event. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we had a great time. Gudrun?
Yes.
You were there, Brian?
I liked it.
Was there. And he got us marshalled into teams. He had a very efficient marking scoring system. And also, he was on there for several inquiries that people made during the evening about, is this word a word? Can we use this word? There were a few arguments that went on. And he said he often goes around small Scrabble groups. And he said there are always disputes. So we had a very lively evening. And I think everybody enjoyed themselves. And I think it was George who came out with the winning. He got the word holiday, didn't he? Mm. And how many did he...
84.
84 for that.
Yeah.
Mm. And he got the overall highest score.
Yes.
And Brian, you did quite well, didn't you?
I was second.
You came second. What did you get as your prizes?
I got a Scrabble mug, a very nice one with the letter I on it, or perhaps it's the number one. And I got a cookbook.
We got a lot of donation from different countries, from Nigeria, from India, from Hungarians. Yes, from Italy.
Yes.
So was a lot of food there.
Roger Wicks and I have both tried to write stage musicals about teenage love affairs, and both our stories have a bitter edge. This song, called The Way That I Love You, is the gentlest and most romantic number from Roger's play Tyneside Rain. It's beautifully performed here by his former student, Jodie Nicholson.
Getting through. to the wall. You're heading for a fall. Sleepwalking through it all. This is your wake-up
is how I met my friend Brian, and I would like to think that he developed a passion for me before developing a passion for lost gloves. We both worked in Covent Garden. The market was still there. It was 1971, and so a very different place from today. It had yet to become corrupted by property development and money. There were lots of small independent shops, and the shop in which I worked specialised in semi-precious rocks and stones for people to make jewellery, called a lapidary shop. There was also a small craft shop around the corner. And in the basement of the lapidary shop, Brian worked in this windowless, timeless existence. I enjoyed a comparatively sunlit existence in the lapidary shop above. Brian would appear occasionally with bundles of parcels to take round to the post office, which was just round the corner in Holborn. And really, that's all I saw of him until he came up for a coffee break. And then we got to know each other quite well. As I said, the area at that time had a wonderful individuality. Market men would appear in the shop at the end of the day's trading, offering bargain fruit and veg. And there was a market pub which opened well before breakfast time so that market traders could start their work in the morning after customary liquid refreshments. As I said, Brian and I got to know each other, and eventually he moved into my flat in Fulham. The rent was an astronomic 12 guineas, that's £12, 12 shillings per week. We had a room each, and we each paid £3, 3 shillings for our room. Plus, we had shared kitchen, dining room, bathroom, and an upstairs patio garden. Not bad for £12, 12 shillings a week. Brian's subterranean existence eventually finished, and he went on to become a journalist. And I also moved on to do other things. I'll always remember the Covent Garden of those times. It was a very friendly and interesting place to live, not disrupted by money or status. It was just a very homely place where everybody knew everybody. So, you know, there was a time where it was a great, great place, and every time I go there, I get a bit sad, really, because it's not what it was.
Forest Radio brings you the story of the man who photographs gloves.
Gloves, yes, I see gloves. Yes, why?
Well, that's a really good question. There's not really an
we didn't get that far,
though.
Yeah. Why was it important?
It's such a sad thing to... Well, it sounds insane, but it just seems such a sad thing to see a glove lying there forlornly in the pavement. Yeah. Or stuck on top of a hedge or whatever.
Mm.
Because they always take on these dramatic poses as though they're reaching out to be rescued from this isolation.
Mm.
And you know that at some time after that, somebody got home and discovered they'd lost a glove.
Yes.
And they were never, ever going to be able to find the lost glove.
No.
So in a way, I'm recording these gloves on behalf of these owners.
Yes.
Apart from which, it looks really quite funny when you see the whole lot of them.
So would you give the photograph to the police?
No, I would not give it to the police. I regard the authorities should be able to deal with this by themselves. The resources are obviously greater than mine.
It may not be such a high priority as some other things.
I can't imagine them cancelling or leave, no.
No.
Or having a fingertip search or something.
Could you not...
No pun intended.
None.
Could you not put your photographs into the local paper?
Yes, I
Does
could.
Anybody recognise...
Oh, I see, I'm getting that, yeah. Well, some of them have been on the street for so long that people would like to claim them. I've actually seen a little mitten, a little green one, hanging from a fence for a whole year now. And I think that child has probably outgrown it, apart from the fact his mother would probably be revolted at the thought.
and did you hear... Make the right side loss and left hand loss.
I think it comes out that evenly distributed. I thought initially they'd all be around bus stops, for example, or outside supermarkets, but not at all. You find them everywhere.
Yes.
On every street in Britain, there is a lost glove lurking somewhere.
What is the strangest place you have found a lost glove?
Good question. I found them stuck on funny places, on top of spikes, for example. So they're standing up in the air on a spike where people have thoughtfully put them so the owner might find them. Tied onto fences, that little one has been on the fence for a long, long time, dangling beside some traffic lights. And of course you see them in the middle of the road, almost completely flattened. And that is an act of great faith to take a photograph of. I usually do that as a longest shot rather than get flattened myself.
That's you need the zoom lens. Have you ever witnessed the actual loss of a glove?
I have not, no. Now that would be that my moral position would be put into serious question then.
It would, wouldn't it?
Then I may have to actually intervene and say, excuse me, just before I take a photograph of this, that's your glove. I feel that would certainly be a test.
Would you have the urge to do that?
I think I would, as a thoughtful citizen.
So you would watch somebody drop a glove accidentally,
take a photograph of it,
and you rush over before the person could pick it up?
Yes, I would. I'd take a photograph and then possibly take it back to the person. If it looked like a decent person.
The person hasn't gone away already.
Well, they may
maybe
have,
you
they
should
may
say, wait a moment, I just take a picture and then I give it to you.
Yes, they'd probably call the police, actually. Or a social worker or something.
Well, part of that story is quite a natural position, though, isn't it? Because sometimes when people drop things, we look and see if they're going to turn back and pick it up, don't we? But you know, we probably stop before we take the picture or anything. But
Well, I'd have to get my camera out, phone out, and pretend it had rung, and go through my nonsense, self-conscious, taking a photograph of a glove in the street routine, so as I don't look conspicuous
so
when a man takes a photograph of a glove.
What do you do with the gloves?
The photographs.
The gloves, the photographs is yes, I can understand you've got those.
I don't touch the gloves.
You don't touch the gloves, you just leave them and move on.
On the basis they may eventually be found.
Yeah.
Yes, but is it not inspiring for you when you see the glove? And
I really find the the shapes they take on really quite seductive in a way, you know, because they really do look as though they're reaching out, and you think it's so lost and it's never going to be reconciled, you know.
What if you saw a foxglove? Would you take a picture of it?
No, I don't think I would.
Even if it had been lost by a fox?
Yeah, no, I don't think you can wear that, you see.
Yes, but did you have any experience yourself when you lost your glove and your hand got cold and you was in the ice, the weather outside or so?
No, I'd never been aware of losing a glove until much later. I suppose that's part of the thinking. That it's been hours later, I thought, oh God, I lost the glove. But where's that glove gone? And then you look all over the place and you discover it's gone forever. And that's the same drama as every single one of my lost glove photographs has experienced.
Yeah.
May I ask how many you have?
Probably about 40 odd.
Wow.
And that includes a season, a winter, where the camera was broken. Mm-hmm. So that was just done in a matter of months. Obviously, the summer season is, even in Glasgow, there's not that many gloves about.
No.
Well, I think for short story purposes, we'll have you witnessing the amputation of a hand for stealing in a Muslim fundamentalist country. And then you get obsessed with photographing gloves.
Yeah. In the hope of restoring this problem.
Yeah, have you got an ending for me while you're here?
No, I have to say I haven't. No, it's
I'll have to work on that
continuum,
myself.
As it were.
How about white coats, carried away?
Yes, I see where you're coming from.
And then you realise all the men in white coats are wearing dark gloves.
Oh, no!
And one of them drops the glove as well.
Yeah.
I had just the story in mind. There was a little child and he got from his aunt gloves and he hated those gloves. And on the way, he threw one away and after in another street, he threw another away.
Oh, we can have him in the story too.
Right. Okay.
The idea is simply that I just thought there must be something in the streets that interests me.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds ridiculous to say, but... and so one day I was walking through a park in Glasgow and I saw a red and blue baby mitt lying there and I thought, that's it. That poor wee glove with its funny sort of grasping shape.
Yeah, the shape of the hand.
Pleading to be lifted up is there's such a sad little drama in there, you know. So I took a photograph of it, and within about 100 yards, I'd found another one, not the match of the baby mitt, but a regular human adult.
That's
hand.
Distinct from baby.
Yeah, quite so. And it similarly had this curious, pathetic look about it, and I began to think I should record all these little dramas. Of these, oh God, I've lost a glove, you know, kind of thing, and then never being able to reconcile this with finding it again. And these gloves were just lying around there forever until they eventually swept out. And I have taken dozens of photographs of them.
Wow.
Is there some sort of technical sort of word for this?
We'd have to look up the Latin for glove.
Yeah, it's probably
exactly,
something like that.
Find
yeah.
out.
So slightly right. bonkers is probably as technical as it gets.
Well, all right, okay.
It all depends on whether you intend to make an exhibition of
well,
this.
Well, the thing is, I was at the Centre for Contemporary Arts in Glasgow not long after I started doing this, and people have been saying to me, you know, are you going to make an exhibition? And I thought this was ridiculously highfalutin, you know. Never occurred to me. Anyway, in the Centre for Contemporary Arts this very week... was an exhibition of, would you believe, posters for lost pigeons from Ghent in Belgium. And they weren't just they were racing pigeons that had been flying from Marseille or something like that and crashed into...
Had there been birds of prey, you could have made a link.
Exactly. So I thought, well, lost gloves don't seem quite as daft as I thought it was.
Well, Jean knows somebody who got into an art exhibition by gluing pieces of cooking foil to a cardboard box.
Well, there we have it.
I think your gloves trump that.
Absolutely. I never try to make it look as though I'm taking a photograph of a glove in case people think I'm crazy. So I usually go through a pantomime of, oh, goodness, my phone's wrong, you know, and sort of fiddling about with it.
Ah, I see, yeah.
Focusing on the glove on the ground.
I see.
It adds to the drama.
Yeah, there's an element of shame involved.
There is a certain sort of self-consciousness. Why? It just seems crazy to take a photograph of a glove lying in the middle of a gutter.
So, I would.
Well, I do, but I still think it's slightly nutty.
Well, my immediate thought is there's a short story in this.
I was just going to say, there's a short story involved, isn't there?
About the man who took photographs of gloves.
Exactly.
Good God. Jeez.
This could win the BBC's annual competition.
Well, I'm more concerned with, you know, whether you get the glove back to the owner.
No, I take no hand in the glove, as it were.
Sorry, that's the question.
That's irresistible, isn't it? But I once was about to take a photograph of a glove when the owner actually appeared and jumped in front of me.
Ah.
And I must admit, this was a pretty flash-looking glove. It was leather. And there was fur sticking out, so it was obviously quite an expensive number.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just about to go through my, who's this, in the phone routine, when suddenly this woman shut me out of the way and grabbed the glove and marched off with the other one in the other hand. So that's
fantastic.
The closest I've been to actual intervention in the glove sense, yes.
I actually did write a short story called New Gloves, and it did fairly well. It was bought by the Sunday People, I think, eventually.
Wow. Oh, very good.
So we're going to have a glove theme.
Glove theme.
Thank you, Brian. Right.
Decision time. We'll keep you here for a couple of days, said the doctor to Rose, just to clarify the reason for the bleeding. I don't think it is serious, but we have to take your age in account. He took a quick glance at her file. You gave birth to one child and you had one miscarriage in between, as I can see. Here it was again, the phrase that caused her anxiety. Because of your age. The doctor had said when she saw him after the test, a pregnancy above the age of 35 is regarded as a risk. That doesn't mean anything bad, he added hastily when he watched her worried expression. It is only a standard medical term. Of course, in an advanced age, the danger of malformation increases slightly. I suggest you should have an amniotic fluid test, a procedure to be sure that everything is okay with your baby. There's a very minimal risk of miscarriage through the puncture, but nothing to be worried about. He had handed her a leaflet to us. This gives you more detailed information. I suggest you read it at home, he had said, and during your next visit I can make an appointment in the clinic for you, if you want it. It's your decision. At home, Rose had studied the leaflet carefully. The very minimal risk or complication occupied a whole page, followed by a list of the indication and the results of the test, which shows possible conditions like Down syndrome and spina bifida. She had been so happy after the positive outcome of the pregnancy test, and now all her confidence had gone. It was true, she had a miscarriage before, and she was 41 years old, but she had never thought that this could make any difference. What shall I do, she asked. She had asked herself, and then had shown Vincent the leaflet, had repeated the doctor's advice, described her feelings, her self-doubts, her inner turmoil, and asked for his advice. Should they really take the risk? It's your decision, he had answered, and she wasn't sure whether that meant whatever you decide, I will be with you, or you will have to face the consequences alone. Making decision had always been her weakness, no matter how trivial or important the issue. You choose, she liked to say to Vincent when they sat in a restaurant studying the menu, after which she lunged back in her chair relaxing, her slim hands resting on her lap, her feet crossed. She was waiting for him to place the order. "Where would you like to go?" she would ask him on another occasion when they were discussing the next holiday, being unable to make a quick suggestion. She always hesitates before making a final decision, as if she fears that her own option between the wide varieties of possibilities could force her in an irreversible direction she would later regret. She hadn't discussed her problem with her best friend. "Why are you doing this to yourself?" Jen had said when she had heard about her pregnancy. "Right now, when Ronnie had started school and you are just out of the woods." "You know how much Vincent's want another child," she had answered. "And Ronnie asked me every second day why he doesn't have a brother or sister like his friend." "That's just so typically Jew, you," Jean had shouted angrily. No need for further talks to her about the second child. With a heavy heart, she had agreed to the puncture at the next consultation. The doctor made her an appointment in the clinic in 4 weeks' time, and when she left his surgery, she felt somehow relieved that at least she had made a decision. The following weeks, she was in good spirits around her family. She made jokes, served them their favorite meals, told Ronnie that they were going to have a baby, and he was excited. And then, 4 days before her appointment with the clinic, she started to bleed. Not much, only a spotting, as the nurse called it. But they kept her in the hospital for a couple of days to keep an eye on it. Rose was held the information about her appointment. She hoped that if she was kept in the hospital for at least 5 days, she would miss the deadline. Vincent and Ronnie came for a visit after work. They hugged her and squeezed her hand. "Everything will be all right," Vincent said. "Don't worry, sweetie. The doctor told me they will probably release you tomorrow after the ultrasound scan." They hugged her once more, wished her a good night, and then they were gone, and she was alone again with her thoughts, with her doubts, with her dilemma. At night, she lay sleepless in her bed. "Tonight I have to come to a decision. It's not the fear of the miscarriage alone that worries me. It is the outcome of the test. What if the result says there's something wrong with the child, like a severe disability?" she asked herself. "What if I'm forced to make an even tougher decision? What if my child has an abnormality or serious health condition? Will I be able to manage? How will my family cope with it? Is it irresponsible to deliver a child when you already know it will suffer lifelong pain?" She thinks of a young woman who lived in her neighborhood years ago. She had a little girl, 4 years old, with spina bifida. The child suffered from a paraplegia and malfunction of the kidneys. The mother confided to her in a neighborly chat one day. The child had a sweet little face, a head full of blonde curls, and a charming smile. The young mother was strong, a fighter for her beloved child. But it is true that the family broke apart. Her husband had left her, and the elder son almost certainly had a hard time. The little girl had died 2 years later. Did her mother regret giving birth to this child? Was it better to end its life before it saw the light of day, to save it from pain and harm? Surely there must have been happy, blessed moments in this short life. There must have been an overwhelming love in the everyday living, which gave the young mother the strength and solace she needed. She remembers another incident, which happened on a bus. A boy about 10 years old with Down syndrome was sitting in front of her, accompanied by a young man. They had clowned around, and the boy had squeaked cheerfully. Spittle had dropped from his open mouth. When the two left the bus, the woman opposite hissed to a fellow passenger, "In our time, such a child needn't be brought into this world." Rose had been shocked. She had given the woman a nasty look, but that was all. Why didn't I say anything, she asked herself now. Is it enough to just look angry? Am I a coward? Not strong enough for life's challenges? Rose argues with herself. She feels the pressure weighing heavily on her chest. But suddenly hot anger arises from inside her. Why do I struggle over a very small possibility of malformation or sickness with my baby? I should have more hope in the future. This sort of stress is not good for the child. She closes her eyes, trying to relax and concentrate on this nascent being inside her womb. She places her hand softly on her belly. The picture of the ultrasound comes to her mind. The tender body, the big head with the eyes still closed, and the tiny fingers clenched into fists. And suddenly she senses a light movement, like little bubbles, which rise up and down inside water. A wave of love and tenderness flows through her body. It's moving, she thinks, deeply touched. And love overwhelms her. And at this moment, she's sure. Never ever would she take any risk that could harm the precious life of a little baby.
And that was our friend Gudrun reading her lovely short story, Decision Time, which is published by a group of writers from Harrow Green Community Library Creative Writing Group, and the book is called Buzzwords 2. And they've got lots of lovely stories to go in it. So,
and if you did want to copy, it's on lulu.com, the American printers. Yeah, publishers.
Thank you, Gudrun and David. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the opening of Beethoven's Klavenkonzert No. 5, Opus 73, and the soloist was Frederick Gulda. That was chosen by Gudrun. Well, this is my chance to try to explain what, in my view, is going on here in Walthamstow with this massive new building project to build four huge tower blocks of luxury flats in the middle of the town square, effectively, which will completely blight what little public space remains. They also want to take away a third of the public space in order to extend the shopping mall further out into the town square. And the maximum height of these towers, which they've asked for, is 132.5 metres, which is approximately 15 metres higher than Centre Point on Oxford Street. Essentially, the council is being asked to agree to this sacrifice of public open space and the erection of these huge blocks in exchange for public benefits that amount to almost nothing. They will probably argue, though not in such stark terms, that they are being held to ransom by the developers, Capital and Regional, who own the mall, because central government funding will be drastically cut in the year 2020, and local authorities will be forced to cosy up to big business in order to remain viable. That at least would be honest. 2020 is the year that local democracy comes to an end to be replaced by the dictatorship of big business. But even if bargains do have to be made and resistance to these political pressures is judged to be futile, there's no reason to accept the first bargain offered if it's not a good one. And this, as we all know, is far from being a good one. But the language in which they've chosen to explain their motives to their constituencies is, of course, very different to these stark facts. The sales pitch is that this is a trade-off and that we should accept it because it'll be to our advantage overall. It isn't, in other words, just a land grab of public space to build private flats where minimal, if any, public benefit will result, because the ordinary people on ordinary salaries can only dream about either buying or renting flats in this price bracket. These are the kind of flats that will be so expensive they're basically commodities and investment vehicles, mainly for overseas buyers. Many of them will probably be left empty as investments. Anyway, we get a bigger portion of a bland concrete shopping centre in exchange, a few more shops with big name chains attached to them, and a few low-paid jobs in retail for Walthamstow residents. The developers hope that we'll get an influx of new, well-to-do people living in this luxury accommodation, and of course many of them will presumably shop in the new, brave new shopping mall, or that's what they hope. That's the point of doing all this. Now, we need to distinguish clearly between any improvements to the public open space and its removal, which is the effect of building on it. It's gone. We who are opposed to the present proposals have no particular position on what we might do to improve our open space. That's a completely separate issue, and in my opinion, this amazing public asset has been underused historically. It could be the scene of events like fun fairs, music festivals, beer festivals. There was one such festival, in fact, the High Tide Festival in September, between September and October. But so many different events could happen here. It should be a buzz of activity at least every weekend, in the open air in the summer and under canvas in the winter. That's the kind of development that would really complement the character of central Walthamstow. And if we allow the council to deprive us of this outstanding public amenity right at the centre of the town, all those imaginative possibilities are lost forever. And all that aside, we need some open space to remain sane, and this is the last piece that there is in the centre of the town. If more shops are the key to everything, then there's absolutely no reason why the mall could not be extended upwards instead of outwards. There's already an underdeveloped second story that could be extended to double the floor space without changing its footprint at all. and housing could be on a lower, human scale and further back from the central square. So, my final words to the council are, think again, think harder, you can and must do a lot better than this.
It was in the spring, one sunny day, my sweetheart left me, Lord, she went away. And now she's gone, and I don't worry, Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. She called me up from down in El Paso. She said, come back, Daddy, ooh, I need you so. And now she's gone, and I don't worry, Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. If you don't like my peaches, don't you shake my tree. Get out of my orchard, let my peaches be. And now she's gone, and I don't worry, Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. And don't you come here running, holding out your hand. I'm gonna get me a woman like you got your man. But now she's gone, and I don't worry, Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. It was in the spring, one sunny day, my sweetheart left me, Lord, she went away. And now she's gone, and I don't worry, Lord, I'm sitting on top of.
And now I'd like to tell you about a petition to Parliament to review and reform Stop and Search. Every signature matters. We all want a fairer society. So why are so many innocent black, Asian and minority ethnic people seven times more likely to be stopped and searched by police? Do we even know what effect this has on their health and relationships? How can we, when a national assessment on the effects of multiple or disproportionate stops and searches on the same communities has never taken place? The last 50 years of stop and search wasn't great. Another 50 years of the same stop and search surely cannot be healthy for future generations and the nation as a whole, can it? We therefore democratically request government and UK Parliament to review and reform Stop and Search and to carry out a national assessment on its impact on health. This is how to join the petition for a parliamentary debate. Please join our petition to UK Parliament to gather 100,000 signatures to be put before the Parliament. Download a petition form by visiting www.forestradio.co.uk and fill in your details and then email it to stopandsearch@forestradio.co.uk. Or you can just visit the Forest Radio website for further details.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans, I've got my suitcase in my hand. Now ain't that a shame?
Yes, I'm going back home to stay. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans. You used to be my honey, till you spent all my money. No use for you to cry, I see you by and by. I'm walking to New Orleans. I've got no time for talking, I've got to keep on walking. New Orleans is my home, that's the reason why I'm gone. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans.
Tribute to Fats. Fats Domino's family history starts on the Laura plantation. It's about an hour's drive from New Orleans. His parents, French-speaking Creoles, were still at the Laura plantation at the time of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. Fats' parents, Antoine and Donna Teal, moved to New Orleans, and there Fats was born in Treme, which is the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, the part that got brutally flooded in 2005. Fats was born on the 26th of February, 1928, and he was taught piano from the age of seven. At 14, he dropped out of high school to play in local clubs and bars. And he was then discovered by Dave Bartholomew, who was a legendary band leader, record producer. And he made his first recording, The Fat Man, in 1949. Fats made the recording at Cosimo Matassa's J&M Studios in New Orleans' French Quarter, only a few blocks from his Tremé home. This is a historic studio, and after recording The Fat Man, which of course became an instant hit, many, many famous artists recorded there. One of my first stops in New Orleans was to revisit this historic site, which is now a laundrette on 838 North Rampart. But it has rightly been honoured with a plaque in the name of Matassa. His actual family owned grocery shops in New Orleans. I think they had first emigrated from Sicily. I can remember, and in fact, that there is a Matassa's shop still in, I think it's on Royal Street. And the name itself, if you say to anybody interested in New Orleans music, they'll talk immediately about Matassa and his wonderful recordings. So some of the people who recorded at the studio were Little Richard, Miley Lewis, Dr. John, Ike Turner, Aaron Neville, Ray Charles, Big Joe Turner. You know, it's a huge list. I first saw Fats at the Jazz and Heritage Festival 1979, where he was playing with local musicians aboard the Mississippi riverboat, the SS President. It was certainly a night to remember. Remained in Tremé, simply moving a block up the road and to a bigger house as he became a famous worldwide name. But he was a true New Orleanian, and fortunately he has so many, many followers and admirers. In fact, when Katrina struck, he was thought to have perished until he was rescued, and nobody knew who he was, but he was taken to a hospital, and of course eventually the news got out that he was in hospital. His property had been devastated, of course, but he spent his last years just a few miles down the road, and he spent his last few years in one of the New Orleans parishes. There was a huge funeral procession around the area in which he lived. And if you do want to know more about New Orleans music, John Brovin's book, Walking to New Orleans, is an excellent example. Long live Fats, rest in peace, and you've given millions of us a lot of pleasure. So we'll finish off with, I think, one of his best songs, Wait and See.
The sun gonna shine in my back door someday, just you wait and see, just you wait and see. One day you cry and want me come back to you, just you wait and see, just you wait and see. You've got such great big, big, beautiful eyes, but I love to see you when you smile. The sun's gonna shine in my back door someday, just you wait and see, just you wait and see. Got such a great, great, beautiful smile. You so doggone mean, I wonder why. One day you'll cry and want me come back to you, just you wait and see, just you wait and see.
So this is goodbye from Adele
and David
and Wayne
and Gudrun
and Brian. Thank you.
Well, how do you do, Private William McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside? And I'll rest for a while in the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. And I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the dead heroes in 1915. Well, I hope you died quick and I hope you died clean. Our Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er you as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the farm? Did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. And though you died back in 1915, to some faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enshrined forever behind a glass frame, in an old photograph torn and tattered and stained, and fading to yellow in a bound leather frame? Do they beat the drum slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lower you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Well,
the sun's shining now on these green fields of France. A warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard it is still no man's land. The countless white crosses in mute witness stand to man's blind indifference to his fellow man. To a whole generation who was butchered and damned, do they beat the drums slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lowered you down? Did the bugle sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? And I can't help but wonder now, Willie McBride, all those who lie here know why they died. Did you really believe them when they told you the cause? Did you really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the suffering, the sorrow, and the glory, the shame, the killing, the dying, it was all done in vain. For Willie McBride, it's all happened again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Do they beat the drums slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lower you down? Did the bugle sing the last post in chorus? The pipes play the flowers of the forest.